Sort of is. Okay. Today I'm going to be talking about Isaiah, the verses 38 to 41. And we are carrying on, obviously, from where Richard left us last week. And looking at Hezekiah, in particular, for the first two verses, and how he became extremely ill following the great miraculous deliverance of Jerusalem from Sennacherib. He became ill to the point where he was about to die, and he heard from Isaiah that God had said, put your house in order because you will not survive. And he was suffering, it seems, from some terrible ulcer. It could have been cancerous. It was extremely painful. We know that from the way in which he himself describes it. It might have been some terrible boil that had infected his blood. In any case, he was about to die. But he cried out to God. And he said, I've always done what you want me to do. I've walked in your ways. Why now are you taking my life from me? He was only 39. He wasn't married and felt that he was in the prime of his life, and if he were now going to die, that he would be deprived of what he described as seeing the Lord on the earth. He was not ready to go. And so he was granted 15 more years. Isaiah came to him and said, God has heard your plea, and you're going to live for another 15 years. Put a poultice of figs on the boil, it'll clear up. And it did. But of course, it was not the poultice of figs. It was God's benevolence and grace and mercy that healed Hezekiah, and he survived. Now, what's interesting about this story is Hezekiah was not married at the time he became ill. He therefore did not have an heir. And had he died, it would have been the end of the Davidian line, which of course needed to be preserved in order that we might have Jesus. When Hezekiah was granted life, he seems to have been extremely grateful, and it seems to have taught him a lesson. He says, I will walk humbly all my years because of this anguish of my soul. Lord, by such things people live, and my spirit finds life in them too. You restored me to health and let me live. Surely it was for my benefit that I suffered such anguish. Now, according to rabbinical sources, not biblical, there is a conversation that goes on between Isaiah and Hezekiah at the point that Hezekiah was cured, when he was pleading for his life, and he was querying why it was that he was condemned to die, having been such a good king, apparently the best king in godly terms since David, and he was the 13th in succession after David. And apparently, according to the Talmud, Jewish, the origin of Jewish rabbinical law, it was because God was unhappy with Hezekiah that Hezekiah had refused to marry, because Hezekiah, being very favored of God, apparently had a gift of prophecy and knew that if he went on to marry and also had a son, that he would engender a wicked son, and decided, therefore, that he was going to relieve God of the problems and the difficulties that would ensue from this, and he just wouldn't do it. However, of course, it is God's plan that we are all saved via Jesus, and it was God's plan that Hezekiah should reproduce. And so he went on to marry, apparently, the daughter of Isaiah himself, a lot of people believe, and there's a lot of scripture that suggests that this is the case, and Psalm 45 is supposed to be a celebration of the marriage between Hephzibah and Hezekiah, and Hephzibah being the daughter, perhaps, of Isaiah. It is important, I think, to think about whether or not this could have been the case, because a rabbi, David Aaron, said that God replied to Hezekiah through Isaiah, what business do you have with the secrets of the All-Merciful One? In other words, it's none of your business. if your son will turn out to be wicked, God wrote the script. Your task, Hezekiah, like everyone else's, is simply to do the will of God. Hezekiah did have a son. He had a son called Manasseh, who assumed the throne when he was 12. And Manasseh ruled for 55 years, and he was horrible. He was terrible. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He deliberately set about bringing back polytheism in Jerusalem, and he persecuted the prophets, and in particular, he is responsible for the death of Isaiah, who might have been his own grandfather, and it was a particularly gruesome execution. Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, hollowed out a cedar trunk, put Isaiah in it, and sawed it in two. Nonetheless, what happened was that Manasseh, of course, preserved the Davidian line, and that led eventually to Joseph, and according to Matthew, Mary and Jesus, either by marriage or by blood. Okay. The other thing is that Hezekiah, once he was restored to full health, seems to have also been restored to a certain amount of pride. Many of these kings, even great kings like Hezekiah and David, who were greatly favored, had fatal flaws or parts of their character which were not quite as glorious as they might otherwise have been, like the rest of us. And it seems that pride might have been Hezekiah's, because whether he became complacent following the deliverance from Jerusalem of from Sennacherib, or whether he became complacent having been promised another 15 years and being so favored of God, he showed off his wealth in a way that was to bring about actually the one of the greatest tragedies in Jewish history. Really impressed by the fact that Hezekiah was delivered from death in this spectacular way, the king of Babylon at the time sent emissaries to congratulate Hezekiah, perhaps even looking for an alliance with Jerusalem against the Assyrians. But Hezekiah, I wonder if he was that bright, you know, I don't know. I think just because you're favored of God doesn't mean you're really clever. And perhaps he wasn't all that clever, and that's perhaps why he got such a lot of help. Because what he does is he invites in these emissaries, and instead of just saying, oh, thank you very much for the good wishes, and yeah, we'll consider being allies, he shows them all around Jerusalem. He shows them his palace. He shows them everything. And in fact, Isaiah comes to see him, and Isaiah says, what did those men say, and where did they come from? From a distant land, Hezekiah replied. They came to me from Babylon. The prophet asked, what did they see in your palace? They saw everything in my palace, Hezekiah said. There's nothing among my treasures that I did not show them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your predecessors have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Oh. And Hezekiah replies, the word of the Lord you've spoken is good. For he thought there will be peace and security in my lifetime. So I'm all right, that's okay. But 114 years later, of course, this came to pass, thereabouts. And in fact, under one of Hezekiah's successors, we experience, or we read about the experience of the people of Israel being taken away in exile to Babylon, and Jerusalem trashed because Hezekiah was so complacent or unwise that he allowed these people into Jerusalem. And so God has to replan. Isaiah 41 ends with God telling us about how he will raise up Cyrus. Now, Cyrus will overcome kings of Babylon, and eventually, 200 years from the date in which we're working, will allow the exiles from Jerusalem who were taken to Babylon to return to Jerusalem, rebuild the temple. And so God, in spite of Hezekiah's pride, or perhaps his original disobedience, allows, nonetheless, Hezekiah and his line to, if you like, be repurposed, and the plan is brought to bear anyway, in spite of the best efforts of these people who make mistakes. And we learn that at the end of Isaiah 41, God says, I have stirred up one from the north, and he comes, one from the rising sun who calls on my name. He treads on rulers as if they were mortar, as if he were a potter treading the clay. Who told of this from the beginning so we could know, or beforehand so we could say he was right? No one told of this. So Hezekiah has just allowed the beginning of the events that will lead to the sacking of Jerusalem by Babylon, but within the same verses, God says it's okay. There is a plan. And no matter how you try to thwart it, or how many mistakes you make, or how many people you engender who in future will not honor me, and by the way, Hezekiah's son Manasseh is punished. He's actually led away to Babylon with a ring through his nose, and he's put in irons until he repents. I will bring about my plan. It will come to fruition. And this plan, of course, the great culmination of it is the birth of Christ. In Isaiah 45, 12 to 13, which is out of my jurisdiction for this talk, God mentions Cyrus again. He says, my own hand stretched out the heavens. I marshaled their starry hosts. I will raise up Cyrus in my righteousness. I will make his way straight. He will rebuild my city. So even as people go against God, God is making provision and prophesying how that will ultimately not defeat him. His is the great plan. Now, this is very encouraging as we move into Isaiah 39, and Isaiah 40 and 41, rather, because things get more personal for us. Okay. It doesn't start out as terribly encouraging. God reminds us that we are nothing and reminds us of our impudence, our arrogance. He says that we are grass, flowers, drops in buckets, dust, nothing, worthless, less than nothing, grasshoppers, worms, little, naught, and chaff. These are just some of the ways in which people and princes and nations are described in chapters 40 and 41 of Isaiah. Surely the nations are like a drop in the bucket, or people are grass. They're regarded as dust. People are like grasshoppers. You worm, Jacob, little Israel. He brings princes to naught, reduces rulers to nothing. They wither and sweeps them away like chaff. Doesn't sound awfully encouraging, but then it, like, hugely is. Because it goes on. But comfort, comfort my people. There are two particular bits of scripture in 40 and 41 that I just absolutely love. And that introduction to the idea that people are but grasshoppers and God is enthroned above the circle of the earth is introduced by these words. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood since the earth was founded? He sits enthroned above the circle of the earth, and its people are like grasshoppers. It's like God is saying, for crying out loud, you are so small, you are so vulnerable. Have you not heard? But that sort of language is repeated again when he comes in with the big but. Do you not know? Have you not heard? The Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. And then these verses follow. He will not grow tired or weary, and his understanding no one can fathom. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And you think, wow, I am infinitesimally small, and I am infinitesimally important, and I am strong, and God sees me. And though I am a speck of dust, I can soar on wings like eagles. It doesn't matter how often we make mistakes, how often we fall. God says, I've chosen you and not rejected you. I have chosen you and not rejected you. And then there are these words too. Why do you complain, Jacob? Why do you say, Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by my God. And how often do we do that? How often do we complain and say, my way is hidden from the Lord. My cause is disregarded by God. He can't see me. He can't see me. Where is he? He's nowhere. You don't have to be a king in who God is interested in terms of preserving the line of David for him to hear your cry and answer your prayers. The good news is that these verses are for everyone. They are for us. I was listening to a Radio 4 program on the radio, obviously. Coming home from work on Friday evening, the 19th of January. And did you know, I wonder if you did, perhaps you did, that the first British astronaut in space was a woman? Yeah. Well, it was. We know a lot about Mr. Peake, don't we? Yeah. He was good bloke. But what we don't know is that the first British astronaut in space was a woman called Helen Sharman. And I was listening to her talking on this program on the 19th of January on the way home from work, sometime towards 6 o'clock, in the context of America's new initiative to renew investment in space travel, etc. And she was talking about how incredible it was to be on the space station and the amazing, awesome sights she beheld from the window. And they were traveling around the Earth at 10 times the speed of a bullet, 5 miles a second, and she passed from profound darkness to blinding light in seconds as the space station went round at approximately 17,150 miles an hour round the Earth. But of all the amazing things she saw, Sharman said this: the millions and millions of stars just going on and on. I like to think I saw infinity. It feels as if there is just no end to those stars. All I could say was, ah, and wow. And this is an astronaut, one of the biggest brains on the planet. And she was reduced to, ah, and wow, because of the apparent infinitude of the stars. And as I listened to her, I remembered Isaiah 41, 25 to 26, and these words: lift up your eyes and look to the heavens. Who created all these? He who brings out the starry host one by one and calls forth each of them by name. Because of his great power and mighty strength, not one of them is missing. He marshals the stars. Not one is missing. In the same way, we are part of the constellation that God promised Abraham when he said, Your descendants will be as multitudinous as the stars. That is us. Sure, it began with the Jews, the chosen people. Then it led to Jesus, the disciples. They spread the gospel, the word, first the Jew, but then the Gentile. And now we, by adoption, are Christ's children. We are of that Davidian line. Those stars that were prophesied and foretold when God, whom he calls in these verses, Abraham, my friend, when God addressed Abraham as his friend, and he says in these verses, because you are his descendants, I will care for you, I will look after you. Do not fear. We are those stars. We are the Gentiles who have been grafted on to this Davidian line. Every single one of us, every single one is marshaled. There is a plan from the beginning to the end, and every one of us is known by name. We are part of that constellation. And to finish, these amazing words. I have chosen you and have not rejected you. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous hand. All who rage against you will surely be ashamed and disgraced. Those who oppose you will be as nothing and perish. Though you search for your enemies, you will not find them. Those who wage war against you will be as nothing at all. For I am the Lord your God, who takes hold of your right hand and says to you, do not fear, I will help you. Even though you are a little worm, a flower, a bit of dust, you're my child. And think, if not one star is missing, how much more important you are. And so we go from the supporting of a king, even though God can reduce princes to dust, and did so with some Babylonians and Assyrians. We go from one king whose life mattered to yours and mine who matter just as much. And I've only got one slide, not many gimmicks, I'm afraid, and hopefully it will come up to finish. Here is your God, Isaiah 49. Here is your God. That is him. That's his nature. He's holding your hand. Thank you very much. Thank you. Cut this off.